Okay, well, you know what I'm going to say, so I'll go ahead and do it, but I'm going to make just a little bit of a change this evening because we need to take a run at this one. So turn with me, if you will, to not only where the place where this week's Torah portion begins, which is in Genesis chapter 6, but let's start virtually at the beginning of Genesis chapter 6, because that literally is when the story of Noah starts. And I won't read it all, but I will recap it, because basically it says that men began to multiply upon the face of the earth. They had daughters that a lot of pretty nasty folks that turn out to be the sons of Elohim, a.k.a. the fallen angels. And they thought that these daughters of men were good-looking, and it says they took of them wives of whomsoever they chose. And then that caused Yahuwah to say, my spirit will not abide in man forever. He's also flesh. His days will be 120 years. And it says the Nephilim, plural, and it's that that terminology for these half-breeds, were in the earth, Haaretz, in those days, and also after that. So even though he wiped them out, somehow or other they did manage to come back. When the sons of Elohim came into the daughters of men and they bore children to them, these were also, it says, the mighty men of old, men of renown, and the wickedness of the men in that time was great, said Yahuwah. Every imagination of the thoughts of their hearts were only evil continually, and it literally is kol hayom, all the days. So Yahuwah was kind of disgusted that he'd ever made man. It grieved him at his heart. He said, I'm going to blot them all out. Everything, literally. But it says, Noah found grace, chen, in the eyes of Yahuwah. Now, it turns out that this is the first use of that word, chen, of grace. And as you know, for the those that are of the New Testament that thinks the Bible only begins in Matthew chapter 1, or better still, John chapter 1, let's just ignore everything before this, they have a lot of problems with the terminology that's used here, because Noah found grace in the eyes of Yahuwah. There's a lot of things that we're going to see with Noah as we go through this that turn out to suggest, he knew a lot more about Scripture, at least before it was written down even, the Torah, if you will, the instruction of the Creator, than most folks today in Sun God Day School. Now, that's just one example. Now, verse 9 says this. This is the beginning of the actual parsha for this week. These are the toldot. That word is generations of Noah. Noah was in those generations a man who was a tzaddik. So that word means righteous. Torah obedient. And so he was obedient to the instruction of the Creator. And he was wholehearted. He walked with Elohim. Had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And it says the earth was corrupt in those days, literally filled with decay. And that's the first use of that word here, shechat. And the earth was also filled with chamas. There's a word we've heard a lot lately, violence. And Yahuwah saw Haaretz, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth. And Elohim said unto Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, because the earth is filled with chamas through them. Behold, I am going to destroy them with the earth. And one of the things that is also implied in this, according to the Hebrew definitions and understanding, is thievery. A lot of thievery going on. And I guess you could say, as it was in the days of Moses, so it is today. And that was something that was noted by Yeshua as one of the potential signs of the end times. And can't deny that there's a whole lot of thievery in the world today, too. We have an entire world system based on thievery. So, make yourself an ark, he says. Make thee an ark of gopher wood. Divide it into rooms. You shall make this ark and pitch it. Put pitch to waterproof it. He doesn't say it that way, but that's essentially what the concept looks like here. Pitch it within and without. So, put the pitch on the inside and the outside. This is how you make it. The length of the ark, 300 cubits. Now, remember, a cubit's about a foot and a half, 18 inches, give or take. So, that's a 450-foot long boat. Good size boat. The breadth of it, 50 cubits, 75 feet. The height, 30 cubits. A light you shall make to the ark, and a cubit you shall finish it upward. From the door of the ark, you shall set it in the side thereof with lower second and third stories you make it. And behold, I am going to bring the waters of flood upon the earth to destroy all flesh, everything in which is the breath of life, the Ruach HaChayim, from under heaven. Everything that's in the earth shall perish. But I will establish, he says, Briti, my Brit, my covenant with you, and you shall come into the ark, you with your sons, and your wife and your son's wife with you. And of every living thing of all flesh, two of every sort you shall bring into the ark, to keep them alive with you. They shall be, hey, here's a concept, no transgenders allowed. They wouldn't be any good anyway at the point here. They shall be male and female, and the fowl after their kind, and all the cattle after their kind, of every creeping thing of the ground after its kind, two of every sort shall come into the ark to keep them alive. And you take unto yourself all the food that is eaten, and gather it to you, and this will be food for you and for them. So it says, and this is one of those phrases we're going to see, especially when it comes to Noah, but used a number of times in Scripture. Thus did Noah, according to all that Elohim commanded him, so did he, which is essentially the very definition, I guess you could say, of a Zadok. Then Yahuwah said unto Noah, come, you and all your house into the ark, because I have seen you are righteous before me. There's that word again, Zadok, in this generation. Of every clean beast. Now notice there's a difference here. I usually point this out. It comes as a surprise sometimes to Sunday keepers, because they'll tell you that there's no such thing, and or it's done away with, and Peter's dreamed it away with it. Well, it turns out Noah knew what was clean and unclean animals long before it was even written down in Leviticus or any place else. Every clean beast, you'll take you seven and seven, seven pairs of each, one with his mate. And of the beasts that are not clean, two by two, each with his mate. So here is not only a distinction of the fact that Noah knew what was going on, but we're going to have more of the clean animals as well by six additional pairs. Of the fowl of the air, seven and seven, male and female, to keep seed alive upon the face of all the earth. And yet, he says, for 7 days, and I'll cause it to rain upon the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. Every living substance that I've made will I blot out from off the face of Haaretz. And here it is again. And Noah did according to all that Yahuwah had commanded him. And here's a key indicator. We can use this to establish the timeline. Noah, it says, was 600 years old when the flood of waters was upon the earth. Noah went in along with his sons and his wife, and his son's wife with him, all of them into the ark, because of the waters of the flood. So obviously here we're getting pretty close to the day when it's going to take off. Must have taken quite a while for the ark to be completed. There's some argument about that. I don't necessarily believe that Scripture shows that it's 120 years. But in any case, of all the clean beasts and of the beasts that are not clean, he took the required number, and of fowls and of every creeping thing that creeps upon the ground, they went in, two by two, into the ark, male and female, as Yahuwah commanded Noah. And it came to pass. Now, this is kind of interesting. And this, while we've talked about it every year, somehow or other this year, it seems to me like there's something that's kind of worthy of note here. As I go through it, think about it a bit, if you would. Came to pass after the 7 days that the waters of the flood were upon the earth. Now, it's going to tell us the specifics in a second. 600th year of Noah's life, second month, 17th day of the month, that same day, were all the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were open. And that's when it started to rain. It rained upon the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. But wait a second. I want to gloss over that. It came to pass after 7 days. So Noah went in because the waters of the flood were coming. So the way it looks like this is reading is, and you got to figure, it takes a while. You want to make sure everybody's settled in. So 7 days before the waters opened up on the earth, they were all inside. Now, it does look like they might have come out in between, because we're going to see that they weren't yet sealed in there. But obviously, it's not quite a shakeout cruise. The boat isn't going to float yet. But there are certainly going to be some chances to see if everything is copacetic, and you know, it's going to work for the time that they're going to be on the ark. And I can't help but think that the other indicator here that kind of struck me, like I said, this year, is the fact that there was this advance notice of a week. And now he knows it's fixing to come. So the rain was upon the earth 40 days, 40 nights. That same day, it says, selfsame day, entered Noah and Shem and Ham and Japheth, sons of Noah, and Noah's wife and the three wives of his sons with them, all of them, into the ark. They and every beast after its kind, all the cattle and their kind, creeping things that creep upon the earth after their kind. Notice this use of the word kind here. This is a bigger indicator than just genus and species, as we would say in modern cataloging of life forms. Things like felines, in other words, would be a kind, and canines would be a kind, and so forth. every fowl after its kind, every bird of every sort. They went in, Noah and the ark, two by two of all the flesh, wherein is the breath of life, the ruach, chayim. And they that went in male and female of all flesh, as Yahuwah commanded him, as Elohim commanded him, it says this time. And then Yahuwah, it says, shut him in. So he literally sealed them up at this point. And the flood was 40 days upon the earth. The waters increased. They bore up the ark. So a little while after it started raining, eventually the ark starts to float. It was lifted up above the earth. And the waters prevailed and increased greatly upon the earth. And the ark went about upon the face of the waters. And the waters, it says, prevailed exceedingly upon the earth. And all the high mountains over the entire of heaven that were under the entirety of heaven were covered. 15 cubits upward did the waters prevail, and the mountains were covered. So it sounds like the highest mountain was covered up with about 45 feet of water overhead. All flesh perished that moved upon the earth, both fowl, bird, cattle, beast, every swarming thing that swarms on the earth, and every man, all in whose nostrils was the ruach chayim, the breath of life. Whatsoever was on that dry land, which was no longer dry, it died. And he, it says, blotted out every living thing, every substance even that was upon the face of the ground, man and cattle, creeping things, fowl of the heavens, they were all blotted out from Ha'aretz, the earth. And Noah only was left, along with they that were with him in the ark. And the waters prevailed upon the earth out there for 150 days. Now, chapter 8, we see the first use of another word here, which the root word is zakar, to remember or take note of, I think is another way to put it. Because I don't think it's like he forgot him here in order to remember, as we might think. It's more that he now notices that it's time. He takes note of Noah and every living thing and all the cattle that were with him in the ark. And Elohim made a wind pass over the earth, and the waters assuaged. The fountains of the deep and the windows of heaven were stopped, and the rain from heaven was restrained. The waters returned from off the earth continually, and after the end of 150 days, the waters began to decrease. And the ark rested in the seventh month, on the 17th day of the month, upon the mountains of Ararat. And the waters decreased continually until the 10th month. So 7th month to 10th month. Got almost 3 months here on the first day of the month where the tops of the mountains were finally seen. And it came to pass at the end of 40 days that Noah opened up that window on the ark which he had made. And he sent forth a raven. Now this is always interesting because it kind of begs the question why. And there is, as you might suspect, at least some speculation, but I don't know that we've ever been given a real clear answer as to what this raven is intended to do. Because the raven, it just goes forth. It went to and fro till the waters were dried up from off the earth. That's all we hear about it. And then he sent forth a dove from him to see whether the waters that had abated from off the face of the ground. The dove, though, found no rest for the sole of her foot. She returned unto Noah, to him in the ark, for the waters were still on the face of the whole earth. He put forth his hand, he took her in, and he brought her back into the ark. And he stayed yet another 7 days, and then he sent forth the dove out of the ark again. The dove came into him at evening, and lo, in her mouth there was an olive leaf freshly plucked. So Noah knew that the waters had abated from off the face of Ha'aretz. Then he stayed yet another 7 days, and he sent forth the dove again. This time, she did not return again to him any more. So it came to pass, now in the 601st year, in the first month, on the first day of the month, the waters were dried up from off the earth, and Noah removed the covering from the ark, and he looked out, and behold, the face of the ground had dried. In the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth was, in fact, dry. And Elohim, at this point, speaks to Noah, and he says, so here are the words in red, or at least should be in red, go forth from the ark, you, your wife, your sons, and your son's wife with you. Bring forth with you every living thing that is with you of all the flesh, both fowl and cattle, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, that they may swarm in the earth. Now, notice this. This is, I think, key. Obviously, it's the first commandment that he gives Noah after the flood, and it's also, essentially, virtually word for word, the very same commandment that was given both first to the animals and then also to mankind, Adamkind. Be fruitful and multiply upon the earth. So Noah went forth, his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him, every beast, every creeping thing, and every fowl whatsoever moves on the earth, after their families. They all went forth out of the ark. After their families. That's an interesting turn of phrase, too. Does that mean it's not two by two? They've been in there for quite a while. It may be that there's some of them that have more. Now they've multiplied already. So it doesn't say that explicitly, but just the usage here at least begs the question. So Noah then built an altar unto Yahuwah. He took of every clean beast and of every clean fowl, and he offered burnt offerings on the altar. So at least it looks like Noah also understood one of the reasons for having more of the clean animals was for what was going to happen afterwards, this offering that was going to be made. Olah, right, lifted up. And Yahuwah smelled the sweet savor, and Yahuwah said in his heart, I will not again curse the ground any more for man's sake. Now let's pause there, because that's interesting too. And the question I'll ask is the ground still cursed? Certainly still brings forth thorns and thistles and so forth. Man has to work by the sweat of our brow. We have to grow things in order to have food. That's not the way Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum communists want it. They want you to eat swarming, creeping things that aren't bugs, that are bugs, but in fact aren't generally food in most cases. There are some exceptions, and I don't think they care, but probably they wouldn't want you to have those if they knew that they were actually food. Anyway, the fact that the... He says, I will not again curse the ground anymore for man's sake. Okay, now, when I read this, I would tend to suggest, again, this is just my interpretation of it, your mileage may vary, that he does not have to curse the ground again. It might still remain cursed. But whatever he's saying here, and this is consistent with the other things he's saying, I'm not going to do it again. I'm not going to wipe out the world with a flood, and I'm not going to curse the ground additionally anymore for man's sake. And by the way, that word, of course, is ha'adama, the ground. Because, he says, the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither, again, will I smite any more every living thing as I have done, nor will I smite every living thing as I have done. So if you think about some of the caveats that we hear about and talk about, we know that one of the things we're going to see in this portion is I'm not going to do it and wipe out mankind, Adam kind, by flood anymore. That doesn't mean he might not do a whole lot of damage with fire. But nor will I smite every living thing, all of them, again, as I have done. So that seems to be an additional element of this. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, night and day shall not cease. So as long as earth abides, night and day, summer and winter, cold and heat and harvest shall not cease. And that's a good promise and certainly worth remembering during this time as well. The next chapter says, and Yahuwah blessed. That word here is the root word, right, is Barak or Barhu. And he blessed Noah and his sons, and he said to them, hey, wait a second, here's the second time. It's actually the third time in the book, at least, fourth if you count to the animals, that this commandment has been repeated to mankind. Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. And the fear of you and the dread of you now, he says, shall be upon every beast of the earth, every fowl of the air, and upon all the things wherewith the ground teems. All the swarming things, in other words, and the fishes of the sea. Now, notice, this is the first time we've had the fishes of the sea mentioned. They obviously would have survived through the flood, probably not even noticed a lot of difference. They were deep swimmers especially. But the fish of the sea now are mentioned when it comes to this dread of mankind. Into your hand are they delivered. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you, as the green herb have I given you all. So it looks like, and this is how it's usually interpreted, and lots of commentary on this one, probably worthy of discussion at another time, as to is this a point at which the animals become omnivores and man is given permission to eat meat? Certainly looks like that is the case, because he's also going to then add this. The only thing is, flesh that has the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, you shall not eat. Now, we know that later, this is made very, very clear. You are not to eat the blood, period. And here it is the first time. Flesh with the blood, the life thereof, you shall not eat. And surely, your blood of your lives will I require, at the hand of every beast will I require, and at the hand of man, even at the hand of every man's brother, will I require the life of man. Here we go. By the way, some of you probably heard the term Noahide commandments, and this is where at least those that are formulated come from. These are the things that explicitly were told to Noah. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of Elohim made he man. Now you, he says, you be fruitful and multiply, swarm in the earth and multiply therein. Here it is one more time. And Elohim spoke unto Noah and we sons that were with him, and he said, as for me, behold, I establish Briti, my covenant, with you and with your seed after you. So here is the Noahide covenant, as it's often called. And notice it says, this is my covenant. I'm establishing it with you and with your seed after you. Does that include us? Answer, obviously, it has to. Because we are seed of those who are seed of those who are seed of those who came from Noah, one way or another. I'll establish Briti with you and with your seed. So that applies to us. And with every living creature that's with you, the fowl, the cattle, every beast of the earth, all of you go out of the ark, even every beast of the earth. And I'll establish Briti, my covenant, with you. Nor shall all flesh be cut off anymore by the waters of the flood. So here's the place where he says, I'm not going to do a flood, destruction of the world by flood anymore. Nor shall there be any more a flood to destroy the earth. So it's clear in two different ways. Elohim then said, this is the token, this is the oath, the sign of the covenant, which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. This covenant is still in force. I have set my bow in the cloud. It shall be for an oath, a sign, a token of a covenant between me and the earth. So it's not just between him and mankind. This is between the creator of the universe and all of his creation. Ha-aretz, the rainbow. And it'll come to pass that when I bring clouds over the earth and the rainbow or the bow is seen in the cloud, that I will, zakar, the root word there, recall, bring to mind my covenant, remember, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh, and the water shall no more become a flood to destroy all flesh. Now, notice how much emphasis there is on this sign of the covenant, how important it is to him. It is a perpetual sign. And by the way, it has been absconded with, perverted, turned on its head, and turned into something very much antithetical to him. Be fruitful and multiply. Well, not if you're a follower of the LGBTQ fake religion. This bow, this rainbow, shall be in the cloud, and I'll look upon it, that I might remember the everlasting covenant between Elohim and every living creature of all flesh that is upon the earth. So the very thing which is not just a covenant between Yod-Heh, Vav-Heh, and mankind, but all of the living creatures on the earth is being perverted. And Elohim said unto Noah, this is the token of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is upon the earth. So how much emphasis of that do we need? I guess the point here is, you look at some of the things that are being done, and it looks like there is a deliberate intent to say, if it's something that the creator of the universe says is my covenant, it is between me and all of Ha-aretz. And by the way, you want to destroy Ha-aretz and you want to break his covenant and pervert it and call evil good and good evil? There's at least one place where they obviously started. It says here, the sons of Noah that went forth from the ark, we knew these names, but here we are again, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham, it tells us, interesting, right? This is going to turn out to be important in just a few more verses. Ham is the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and of these was the whole earth overspread. So through one of the three sons came all of the descendants of mankind. Noah, and here, this was an interesting word too. The English renders it as the husbandman. Noah the husbandman began, and he started by planting a vineyard. The word in Hebrew is interesting, right? Ha-adama, ish, ha-adama, man of the ground. As opposed to what? Man of Yah? That's an interesting supposition. Anyway, he plants a vineyard. And you got to figure, there's probably some time goes by here, because how long does it take a vineyard to grow? Even in nicely, recently watered land, that is probably a couple of years. He drank, though, of the wine that eventually came from the vineyard, and he was drunk. and he was uncovered within his tent. So he's lying there, arguably naked within his tent. Was he alone? We're not sure what's going on here. Honestly, folks, there has been no shortage of, as you know, supposition, speculation, even outright, let's make stuff up if necessary, as to exactly what happened. Whatever it was bad, and whatever it was, it caused a curse, not upon Ham, but upon his son. Because it's going to tell us again, Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. So Shem and Japheth took a garment. They laid it upon their shoulders and they walked in backwards and covered the nakedness of their father so that their faces were backward and they did not see their father's nakedness. Now, there are some that will suggest the father's nakedness. Well, that could also mean his wife, because that would be, as we see later, again, with a Torah-based understanding, that would include Noah's wife, who is not named. Again, the point is, we're not 100% sure here. But whatever it was that they weren't supposed to see, they were careful not to. So Noah wakes up from his wine, and he knew what his youngest son had done to him. So he's ahead of most of those who read the story thousands of years later, because it is less clear now, other than, yeah, whatever it was, it is in fact something truly nasty. Because he says then, cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren. And he said, blessed be Yahuwah, Elohim of Shem, and let Canaan be their servant. And he added, Elohim enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be their servant. So it's interesting, because certainly looks like whatever was going on here, it would be a logical assumption that somehow or other, it seems to have dealt with Canaan, the son of Ham as well. Noah lived, though, after that flood, 350 more years, and all the days of Noah, it tells us at the end of the chapter here, were 950 years, and then he died. Now it says, here are the toldot, the generations of the sons of Noah. We know their names, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And unto them there were sons born after the flood. Now we're going to get the genealogy, the toldot, the generations. Sons of Japheth, okay, Gomer, Magog, Madai, Yavan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras. And of those sons, the first one listed is probably the oldest, Gomer, Ashkenaz, Rephath, and Togarmah. The sons of Yavan, and he is down in the list there, Elisha, Tarshish, Kittim, and Dodanim. Of these were the isles of the nations divided in their lands, everyone after his tongue, after their families in their nations. Okay, now some of the sons, you notice, they may have had sons, but were not told in this genealogy their names, or what becomes of them. The sons of Ham, well, we know the name of the first one, Cush. I'm sorry, we know the names of one of them. But the first one is Cush, and of course we remember Cush is that land that later is named, it would seem, Ethiopia. Mitzrayim and Put and Canaan. Sons of Cush, that first one, Seba, Havilah, Sabta, and Raamah, and Sabteka, the sons of Raamah, the last one listed there, Sheba and Dedan. Cush, it says, begot Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one in the earth. So, the eldest of Ham, his firstborn Cush, begets Nimrod, and lots, of course, is to be written about this fella. He is he's kind of considered to be one of the great fathers of evil and especially of paganism. He was, in fact, a mighty hunter before Yahuwah, and therefore it's said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before Yahuwah. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. There might be a similarity there, you probably can guess, with the name Babylon. And Erech and Akkad and Calne in the land of Shinar, also the land that we know as Babylon. Out of that land went forth Ashur, and he built Nineveh. There's a famous city we're going to see later. Rehoboth, Ir, and Calah. And Rezin between Nineveh and Calah, the same as the great city. And Mitzrayim, oh yeah, that name we know too. That's going to be the descendants of this fellow become the Egyptians. He begot Ludim, Anamim, and Lahabim, and Naphtuhim. And I'll go through some of the rest of these fairly rapidly because there are about another three pages almost of them, Pathrusim and Kalsuhim, where forth came the Philistines, and Kaphtorim. Canaan, the one that's been cursed, he begot Zidon, his firstborn, and Heth. Okay, we know about the sons of Heth, and the Jebusite, and the Amorite, and the Girgashite, some pretty nasty names descending from Canaan, and of course living in the land of Canaan. That makes all sense, doesn't it? And the Hivite, and the Arkite, and the Sinite, and the Arvadite, and the Zemarite, and the Hamathite, and afterward were the families of the Canaanites spread abroad. The border of the Canaanite was from Zidon, as you go towards Gerar unto Gaza, we know that name today, as you go towards Sodom and Gomorrah, and Admah and Zeboim into Lashah. These are the sons of Ham, after their families, after their tongues, in their lands, and their nations. Okay, on then to Shem, the firstborn, the father of all the children of Eber, the elder brother of Japheth, to him also, well, he had children. The sons of Shem. So we're going to hear the sons of Shem. Notice that we're going to focus on a couple of the sons of Shem. Elam, Ashur, Arpakshad, and Lud, and Aram. The one that we get told about first, the sons of Aram. Uz, Hul, Gether, and Mash. Arpakshad, that would be the third of his sons. Arpakshad begot Shelah, and Shelah begot Eber. Unto Eber were born two sons, the name of one, Peleg, because in his days the earth was divided. The other's name was Yoktan. Yoktan begot Almodad, and Shelef, and Hazar Maveth, and Yerah. And Hadaram, and Uzal, and Dikla, and Obal, and Abimael, Shelba, Ophir, Havilah, and Yaakov. All of these were the sons of Yoktan. So he had quite a few sons. Their dwelling was from Mesha, as you go towards Sephar, in the mountain of the east. These, it says, are the sons of Shem, after their families, after their tongues, in their lands, after their nations. Now notice, when it comes to the sons of Shem, we're going to hear a lot subsequently, but only from a couple of those lines, or at least primarily from a couple of those lines. These are the families of the sons of Noah, after their generations and their nations, and of these were the nations divided in the earth after the flood. Now this is where the sages get this claim of 70 nations. And now we're going to hear this story about the Tower of Babel, as it's known, because it says the whole earth, Kol Haaretz, was of one language, a language that was echad, it was unified, and of one speech, it was echad. And it came to pass, as they journeyed east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar, a.k.a., later we know, Babylon. They dwelt there. They said to one another, hey, come on, let's make some brick and burn them thoroughly. So they baked brick in the sun. Now, you hear about this time and this technology, this is one of those things that some scholars will focus on and say, yeah, here's the key. If you start making uniform bricks, it becomes easier to build structures consistently, continuously, to make great big long walls and so forth. So this looks like an innovation, if you will, that enabled a significant technological leap in construction. Baked bricks, uniform inconsistency. Let's make some brick, burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, slime they used for mortar. And they said, let's build us a city and a tower with its top into Hashemayim, up into the heavens. Let's make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. And Yahuwah came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men were building. And Yahuwah said, behold, they are a people who are echad, am echad. And they have all got the same language. It is echad as well. And this is what they start to do. Wow. So now he says nothing will be withholden from them which they propose to do. So let us go down and we will confound their language, so that they might not understand one another's speech. Mingled is the root word here in the English, this idea of confounding, which is bala, their language. And it's the reference that I have in the concordance suggests that when you mingle water with oil, this is something you get. I confounded a mingling. So Yahuwah scattered them abroad from there upon the face of all the earth, and they left off trying to build that city. So behold, therefore, the name of the place was called Babel, because Yahuwah there confounded the language of all the earth, and from there did Yahuwah scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. And then it says, here we are, these are the toldot, the generations of Shem. Now notice again, we're going to hear primarily about one son, Arpakshad, not even the oldest. Shem was 100 years old, and he begot Arpakshad 2 years after the flood. And after he begot Arpachshad, he lived 500 years. He begot other sons and daughters. So if you think about it, if you plot out the lifespans on the family tree here, you see that he was still alive. Shem was, in fact, still alive. And it's likely, it's possible, certainly it's been suggested, that he met Abraham. Might have known him. Great, great, great grandson. I didn't count the number of greats there, but you get the idea. Arpachshad, it says here, lived 530 years, and he begot Shelah. After he begot Shelah, he lived another 433 years, and he had other sons and daughters. Shelah lived 30 years, he begot Eber. And after that, he lived another 403 years, he had sons and daughters. Eber lived 34. So he begot Peleg when he was 34 years old. Eber lived after he begot Peleg another 430 years, and he begot sons and daughters. Peleg, at age 30, begot Reu. After that, he lived another 209 years and had other sons and daughters. Reu lived 32 years, and he begot Serug. After that, he lived 207 years, had other sons and daughters. At age 30, Serug begot Nahor. And after that, he lived 200 years, begot sons and daughters. Are we starting to see a pattern here? Notice that the lifespans are decreasing towards this asymptote, it looks like, that we've already been warned about, of 120 years. So as we go through the generations, they are living just a little bit less each time. We're down to 200 years. Nahor, he lived 29 years. He begot Terah. That name is familiar. After he begot Terah, he lived 119 years. And he begot sons and daughters. And Terah, now notice it doesn't say he died, but it seems to be the implication. Terah then lived 70 years. So he's a little older when he begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Now, these, it says, are the generations of Terah. So through the line of Arpachshad and Eber, we get all the way down to this fellow named Terah, who begot three sons, Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Now, these are the generations of Terah. Terah begot Abram, Nahor, and Haran, he had a son named Lot. Haran died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his nativity, Ur of the Chaldees, and Abram and Nahor took themselves wives. The name of Abram's wife, you know it, right? Sarai. The name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, the daughter of Haran, father of Milcah, and the father of Iscah. And this seems to be the only reference to Iscah in the Torah. And Sarai, it says, was barren. She had no child. And of course, as we know, that's going to be part of a longer story. So, Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the daughter of Iran, his son's son, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they, all of them, went forth from there, altogether, from Ur of the Chaldees, to go into the land of Canaan, south and west of there. And they came to this place called Haran, and you can guess maybe it was named after the late father, and they dwelt there. And my notes, and by the way, if you check this on a map, you'll see it. This is perhaps about a quarter of the way from the place where they started out in the Ur of the Chaldees all the way to Yerushalayim in the heart of the land. So they have moved with Terah and the rest of the family here about 25% of the distance that they're going to go. And then it says, and the days of Terah were 205 years, and he died in Haran. And at this point, that is where the Torah portion ends. So what we've seen is the generation of Noah, the flood, and a begin of repopulation, replenish the earth, be fruitful and multiply. Men begin then to spread. Their languages are confounded. They move out. And finally, now we're going to see an emphasis, a focus on the sons of the sons of the son through the line of Terah and this fellow named Abram. And of course, as we know, having read ahead, he is going to end up to be the first of the patriarchs. And this idea of patriarchy is key to literally everything else that we see in the rest of the story here in Genesis and indeed in Scripture.